better with time. We'll mature with age.
Hey, hello, and welcome to the second season of Grapes and Grain Podcast. Ooh. I'm Teeny.
And I'm Laura. And this podcast is, of course, about our favorite things in the world,
alcoholic beverages. Today, we are going to talk about California, but before we do, I just want to give a huge shout out to anyone who listened to our first season.
Yeah.
Thank you guys so much. We got some great feedback and so glad to hear that there are tons of other passionate people about beer and wine out there in the podcast listening world.
Oh my goodness. Heck yeah. And can you list some of the countries that you analytically found that were listening as well? I found that really crazy.
Yeah. We had people listening like in the UK, in Australia. Ooh. Which seemed a little obvious because you were there, but still, we were able to reach people there.
Czech Republic, I think, too.
The Czech Republic.
Dang.
Yeah. I mean, we were just so, I was just like shocked and over the moon by the response that we got. So
we were very humbled, thank you. Very grateful, and I'm really excited to share season two with you as well.
Yes. So today, as I mentioned, we're going to be talking about California.
Love
we
it.
Wanted to start in a place this season, and what better place than to start where basically like the number one powerhouse for beer and wine in the country.
Seriously, serious clout, involved on the scene for quite a while, rich in history and very influential in the innovation as well now too.
Yeah, awesome. Well, before we get started, Laura, what you drinking?
Well, today, so this was tough. There's so many great wine regions in California, obviously. So I actually chose not to go with Napa, but with Mendocino County. So I have a Pinot Noir from 2016 called The Princess and the Peasant.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Reminds me of like The Princess and the Pea.
Yeah. So this renowned winemaker named Roger Scomegna, he found this vineyard about 9 miles off the coast. It had a big diurnal shift, which, you know, is that shift between day and night.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, in his opinion, the perfect place to grow Pinot Noir. So he created a Burgundy style Pinot Noir there. And yeah, this is it. I'm excited.
Very cool.
Yeah. What about you? What you drinking, girl?
What you drink?
Well, today, since we're talking about California, I'm diving back to where sort of the roots of the beer movement in California begin. And that is at Anchor Brewing Company up in San Francisco. And
awesome.
This is their signature Anchor Steam beer. Mm. And this lager is really a testament to California's brewing heritage. So steam was the nickname for a beer, I'm not even drunk yet.
Yeah.
Okay. Steam, it's a nickname for the style of beer that was brewed on the west coast of America under primitive conditions and without ice.
Oh, so interesting.
Yeah, it's
I guess that would be a whole genre. That's a really crazy way to categorize something, but
for
sure. That was a plight.
Well, the origins are thought to relate to the practice of actually fermenting the beer on San Francisco's rooftops in the cool climate. And, you know, in lieu of ice, the foggy night air naturally cooled the fermenting beer.
I love it.
It created steam as it went up into the warm open pans or off the warm open pans.
Cool.
So today this style is also called a California Common. And according to the BJCP, which, if you don't remember, is the Beer Judging Certification Program, the guidelines assess this beer based on taste, not how it's brewed anymore.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So it usually has a pale ale malt, not citrusy hops, and some sort of like toasted or crystal like specialty malt.
Mm.
But the big thing here is the yeast, because it uses the lager yeast at warmer temperatures. You know, lager yeast ferment at colder temperatures, but
right,
this one is
right
at a warmer temperature,
huh,
because of how it was historically fermented.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So
very
all
neat.
Of this means like this beer is, I mean, you can see it's a beautiful color, nice and malty, toasty, often rustic. So I'm excited to drink it and
very
toast to
cool.
California.
Yeah. Cheers to California.
Cheers.
Cheers.
That was
so dull.
After all of that.
Oh, okay. So should we, I guess, then start with the foundations of history? Tell me more about the history of beer.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Outside of steam.
Okay. So, as I mentioned, Well, actually, we'll get to that. So the California Craft Brewers Association says it best. The first time I went to their website, I was like, oh, this makes so much sense. The history of craft beer across the nation begins in California's Bay Area. Mm. So the story of American beer follows the British immigrants who colonized the country. So yes, in general, like in the country, the Northeast is sort of where brewing started, just because that was what was colonized first.
Right.
But California is credited with pioneering the modern post-prohibition movement.
Yep. And that makes total sense.
Yeah. And it all starts with this beer right here in my hand. Anchor Brewing Company was actually founded in 1896 in San Francisco by a German brewer. Now, I'm looking at this name and I have no idea how to pronounce it. Gottlieb Berkel, I think, was his name.
I think you nailed Gottlieb. Nailed it. Yes. I would not have even gotten out of that.
All right, we're starting off strong.
Yeah.
Okay, so Gottlieb Berkel and his family, they arrived in the Bay Area a couple of decades earlier to get on that California Gold Rush action.
Man, yeah.
So in 1871, he actually purchased a billiard bars and beer saloon near Russian Hill and opened it as a brewery. It's kind of unclear like what the name is, but according to Anchor's website, Berkel got it for a cool $3,500.
Wow. So would this be like one of those, like in the movies, old timey's Gold Rush like saloon type establishments? Wow.
Yes,
cool.
I really think so. This is what I'm picturing in my head.
Yeah.
This is like, I want to follow that dough and then I'm also going to brew some beer.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Go get her.
So 25 years after he does that, there's another German brewer. His name is Ernest F. Baruth. Mm. And his son-in-law, they purchased the joint from Gottlieb and they renamed it Anchor Brewing. So no one knows why they chose the name Anchor, except that maybe it alludes to like the booming port of San Francisco. Mm. So this poor brewery, it's like so old, but it is like the history is up and down and up and down.
Yeah.
Because a decade later, there's a big earthquake. And in 1906, the brewery goes up in flames because of fire caused by the earthquake.
No, that is just like doubling down on disaster.
Yeah. Well,
it's terrible.
Let me double down your double down because they were working to open a second location, but Baruth suddenly died. And then his son-in-law got hit by a streetcar.
Oh, my God. What happened with his family? Someone curse it.
I have no idea.
A Romani woman cursed their family.
All on the brewer's website, too. I was just like, damn. But luckily, a couple of other German brewers, apparently there were a lot of Germans in Northern California, they and a liquor store owner, they stepped in and they kept the brewery going.
Wow, okay.
So in 1920, the brewery shuts down again. Mm. But in 1933, after Prohibition, Anchor Steam Beer comes back on the market.
And why is 1920 important? Is it because 1919 is when that
Prohibition
law Prohibition
yeah,
happened.
So Prohibition happened.
So and then 1920, the following year, they shut down.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And then when Prohibition ends, they pop right back up. And good for them.
They pop back up. And then they close again in 1959 after everyone gets on board with all the mass-produced beers. I know. That's why I was like, I felt like I needed to include all of this information. But then there's another new owner and he opens Anchor at another location. And then a couple years later, he too is ready to call it quits. And like, this could have been where the story of Anchor ended. Except there was this gentleman, dun, dun, dun. His name was Fritz Maytag and he steps in. And as the story goes, he was at a restaurant enjoying his favorite local beer, Anchor Steam Beer, when the bartender casually mentioned like, hey, buddy, that could be your last Anchor Steam Beer. And he was like, what's going on? It's like, the brewery's about to close again. Mm. Next day, he walks down there and purchases 51% of the brewery and saves it from bankruptcy.
He's like, I really just want to keep drinking this
beer
at my bar. Yeah.
Yeah. So in 1971, he begins bottling Anchor Steam, which is 100 years after the brewery's original founding.
So were they only doing kegs before that? Or what do you mean bottling?
Yeah.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah, it was only probably available on draft.
Interesting.
And cans were preferred two bottles in the beginning, but I'm not sure that they really...
I forget about them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but then because it's 1971, this brewery is able to lead the charge for all of the other Californian breweries. The next one to come about is in 1977. And that's New Albion Brewery.
Yep.
Albion Brewery? Yeah. Okay. And then in 1980, Ken Grossman opens Sierra Nevada
Brewing
Company.
Totally. I was wondering when that one would pop up.
Yeah. And he revolutionizes what beer can be in America. So, like, yeah. The Sierra Nevada Pale
Ale
was the first of its kind.
Yeah.
And obviously,
influential for so many people, too.
That's what I was going to say. Me coming up in the beer scene, I feel like Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, and especially the Pale Ale, was one that, like, opened the gates to try other things.
Right. The first beer you had, we were like, damn, that's a beer.
Yeah. And it's also always a classic, too. If I see it on the shelf compared to anything else, I'm like very likely to pick it out.
Yep.
So let's see. Fast forward. This is all happening 70s, 80s. Mm-hmm. In 1982, California legalizes the brew pub. And a couple of other things happen around there. But okay, fast forward to today. I know you guys want to hear about what's happening in California today.
Please.
So as of 2017, there are 764 breweries in the state, although that's from the Brewers Association, and the California Craft Brewers Association says that there are now more than 900.
Oh, wow.
That makes 2.6 breweries per 100,000 adults over 21, which is just amazing. And the state makes more than 3 million gallons of beer per year, which is the most in the country.
Wow.
Yeah, overall, it's just a powerhouse. And it's not just the quantity of beer either that they're producing. It's the quality of beer. So they revolutionized the industry. They are setting the pace. GABF, they are always one of the biggest winners. I think in 2018, they took home 72 medals.
Yeah.
And there are only something like 150 categories. So, Oh, and including one really important one, as we discussed last season, the Hazy IPA was buzzy new style of GABF 2018. Black Market Brewing I didn't write down where it was. Southern California, I think. Black Market Brewing, they won the gold in the double Hazy IPA. Alvarado Street Brewing, also in California, won silver in the double.
Yeah, Temecula, just to be accurate.
Temecula?
Yep.
And then King's Brewing Company got bronze in the Hazy Pale Ale. So like three breweries placed in all three of those really high profile categories.
Very cool.
Anyway, that was a long-winded way of how we got here.
That's a really sordid history for California. It is.
Yeah.
It's a long-standing, with wine, too.
Yeah. They were chasing gold, and they found liquid gold.
Yeah.
What about with wine?
Well, wine goes back a little bit earlier than that, but just because, you know, like monks and Catholics and stuff. So,
and because wine is like, we were there first.
It's the it kid.
Yeah. Never to be outdone.
So we're going to bring it back to our first episode of season one.
Mm-hmm.
You remember Junipero Serra?
Serra. I remember that we had to figure out how to say his name quite a few times. Tell me, what was he about? I forget.
Okay, so he is the monk, Franciscan monk, credited with spreading the cultivation of wine grapes and also palm trees, coincidentally, across California through the 1760s.
Okay.
So Junipero Serra was actually born in the Mediterranean, but as a young man, he took that really long, old school wooden boat journey across the ocean, which just seems so arduous to me.
He immigrated on a boat?
No, as a monk, went to the Spanish colonies in Mexico.
Oh,
so he was just feeling really like, he was always like top of his class and like, you know.
Out to spread the word.
Yeah. So he really seized the day. And he got really sick on the journey, actually. This is, like, gives a little bit about his character. He got like super ill. And then when they landed on shore, he insisted on walking the 200 miles to Mexico City. And that was kind of like a display of willpower and stamina he would become known for as he like started opening these missions.
Yeah.
But also, I feel like it's appropriate to say he was kind of an intense dude and was like really into whipping himself and also like really into whipping the Native Americans that forced into the missions.
I was
going to
say, if you're sick and you force yourself to walk 200 miles, like, whose fault is that?
The like European Catholic 1700s were kind of like into all of that. Like, I guess it's called like flagellation or whatever. But anyways, all that to say, he's really venerated in some groups, but really like questioned in others because of his treatment of the Native Americans.
Okay.
So anyways, all that to say, sordid history, but he was extremely influential in the start of wine in California.
Mm-hmm.
So he spent two decades doing mission work through Mexico and then moved up to Southern California, where he opened up a string of 9 missions and pretty much led the sect of Franciscan monks. So part of the work to open the missions was planting these acreages, vineyards mm-hmm. for the sacramental wine, and also planting the groves of palm trees for the fronds and the ashes used in Catholic ceremonies.
Oh, that's interesting. So like palm trees, they planted the palm trees? They weren't just there?
So there's like 1 to 2 native palms to California, but it really wasn't like the crazy, you know, every time you think California, you think of like palm trees on the horizon, the sunset.
It nice and beachy.
Was not so much like that until like the mid-1700s when they started planting them. And then people were, as they grew really well, they, with manicured lungs, they really like matched the watering schedule. So they kind of like took off.
All right. Well, sorry for that tangent. I just thought that was kind of interesting.
I actually went down a rabbit hole when I was researching too for like 20 minutes researching palm trees.
Yeah.
Because I was like, wow. I learned it real hard. Trees.
Botany.
Yeah.
Herbology.
So, all that to say, his grapes were so ubiquitous across the state. They were known as mission grapes, and they were really widely used until the 1880s. And this is important because that's also the same time your beer starts popping up.
Yeah.
Because all the gold rush, these miners and all these people go out there and they want something to drink, you know, mm-hmm. and this like watery sacramental wine is really not cutting it. So they start making the beer. They start planting other styles of vines like Zinfandel.
Ooh.
Yeah. So which is cool. Really great timing because at the same time in France, phylloxera was wreaking havoc. And remember, we talked about phylloxera.
I remember phylloxera.
Yeah.
More than I remember.
Who could forget the first time you heard about phylloxera?
Ravaging the vines.
Yeah. So it is. It's a lice-type bug that eats the rootstock of vines and kills them. And this was decimating the wine industry in France around, like, 1860. And so many of the prominent French wine growers moved to California and began plying their trade there, which is also coincidentally where they ran into T.V. Munson from Texas, who we mentioned several times, who pretty much figured out what rootstocks you could put these wine grapes on.
Yeah.
Shout out T.V. Munson.
Whoop, whoop.
So, but
you said that was in Florida?
California.
Oh, California. Sorry.
Yeah. And T.V. Yeah. Where are we talking
I don't know.
About?
That's why I was like.
Did I say Florida? I might have.
Maybe I tuned out for a second.
We'll check the tapes.
Yeah.
So, anyways, all these really crazy prominent wine growers are beginning to plant vines in California. And this is where places like Napa and Sonoma have their roots in this like gold rush era planting. Mm-hmm. And it continued to thrive. And as wine started to falter in Europe, California started meeting that demand and like exporting it globally. Mm-hmm. Until Prohibition.
Oh.
Yeah. Until 1919.
Womp womp. Prohibition is such a bummer.
What a bitch. So, to put it technically, it was ruined by the 1919 ratification of the 18th Amendment of the United States Constitution. It effectively destroyed the wine industry and all of its momentum in California.
Mm-hmm.
And it also had this like weirdly unforeseen tragic effect on the wine industry on a deeper level, because there was a loophole in this law that you couldn't sell alcohol, but each home could, in fact, ferment their own 200 gallons themselves a year.
Oh, interesting.
So they couldn't buy wine, so a ton of people just started amateurly making it at home. And there was such a demand for the grapes in California, I mean all over in the America, and the price shot up. And mm-hmm. to meet the hot new high volume and demands, growers started tearing out all of these old vine, European vines, and just planting in really high yield, high volume, tough grapes that they could ship all over the country. So
quality sounds like it suffered
so
a little bit.
So that just like was a decimating hit.
That was a double whammy. Just like.
Yeah. Rooted out. Like literally.
Yeah.
Until 1933 again, when Prohibition was repealed, things start turning around slowly.
Like how long did it take for the wine industry to come back? It took beer industry over 50 years.
Like honestly so long. So I found some numbers that basically said wine production in California had dropped 94% during Prohibition. And I'm pretty sure the 6% that were still making wine was literally only sacramental wine.
Mm-hmm.
And then like these home amateurs as well. Less than, this is kind of random too. Less than 100 of the 2,500 commercial wineries around the U.S. actually survived. So, I mean, it was all over. It wasn't just California.
Yeah, same thing with beer. It was like only the big manufacturers who could make raw materials or, you know, like Coors Brewing Company had a porcelain company that they were making all sorts of things and soaps. And,
yeah.
So unless you could manufacture something else, you died.
So one of the first real boosts you see, though, after Prohibition is during World War II. And it's because of some odd government intervention. So spirits and beer were harder to come by for consumers because the distilleries and plants were being repurposed for war efforts. So there was just like not as much of it.
Sure.
It was used for other things. So wine sales increased because it was the easiest choice to get drunk.
Yeah. So, most readily available.
Right. And then in addition to that, the government also influenced the large scale grape production in California as a whole because including they started including raisins in military food packs. So,
It just got
a lot of farmers and a lot of, you know, people of the trade again.
Lots of crop.
More vineyards were planted to meet all the demands. So, but even with all this growth, California did not hit its stride where you see it at today until the 70s. Mm. So this little thing happened in Paris called the Judgment of Paris. And
so judgy.
Yeah. So basically there's this blind wine tasting competition in France. And the panel of judges, by the way, were all French. And they had a red category and or a cab category and like a white category. So a Napa California Cabernet and a Napa California Chardonnay won both of these blind taste tests.
Mm.
And it like blew the wine world up. Like
could
fucking believe it.
I'm sure there were some European people with their heads flipped inside
out
of that.
They were like, no, I don't believe this happened. So they set up, they restaged like this whole tasting again. And these wines like still won the second time they did a second blind tasting.
Did they have like different judges or?
I can't remember. I didn't look up that. I didn't go that far down the rabbit hole, but there is a movie about it. It's not the best movie ever. It's called Bottle Shock. But there's also just a lot of writing about this because it was like such a shockwave for the wine community in the 70s. And so the two wines that won actually were Stag's Leap for the red Cabernet Sauvignon from Napa and Chateau Montelena for the Chardonnay from Napa as well.
Stupid Americans.
Yeah.
The stupid wine.
Yeah. This swill. But it wasn't. It was just crazy. It was like fruit bomb explosion, and everyone around the world was trying to get their hands on it.
That's amazing.
For sure. And that's pretty much evolved into where we are today with California wines. California produces 90% of all U.S. wines.
Holy cow.
Which is like a big number, but also like not that shocking because they have the wine trade. They have the wine tourism. They have the everything.
It's
history.
It's just a really shocking number. Only 10% of the country's wine is made elsewhere. Substantial.
I think what I tried to write in the statistic here is actually California produces 30% more than all of Australia combined. And if California was its own country, it would rank fourth in the world as far as volume of production.
That's amazing.
Right. They're just like pumping wine out over there.
Yeah. Okay. So California is the number one person in America for wine.
Mm.
Number two overall for volume produced of beer in the country.
Oh, wow. Who's doing number one in beer?
You know, I didn't look that up. If I had to guess.
They better watch out because California's coming for them.
Yeah, I guess.
Fast behind.
Let's see. If I had to guess, Oregon, maybe?
That would have been my guess, too. And so some of this, like, really huge growth, I mean, obviously it's been great, but there is some drawbacks. For instance, the property value in Napa and Sonoma are so high now that many family-owned wineries are being priced out and bought up by large-scale wine producers like Gallo and St. Genevieve. And I also actually wanted to get a bottle of that Chateau Montelena for our What You Drinkin' segment. But it was really pricey. Like, Napa wine's really expensive. And even to have a wine tasting experience, like, walk in the door, it's like $50.
Oh, my gosh.
And went everywhere we went in Australia was free. They were just pouring wine down our gullets, you know. Shaking up champagne bottles, spraying it through the tasting room.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding about that part.
There's probably a lot, like, the prices increased a lot after the fires, too.
Ooh, and earthquakes. I mean, earthquake was ravishing for Trefethen, and there's just a lot of natural disaster out there. So I get it. And it's really expensive to be there and live there.
Yeah.
All of it. But I do have a pro tip.
Okay.
For you guys and for our listeners, if you are going to go to Napa and do a wine tasting or wine tour or anything like that, if you are in any way related to a restaurant, travel, anything that you are in the industry of like wine tourism or hospitality, let them know, because you can get industry tours and they are free and they're way more in-depth and you get a bigger tasting selection and a more private experience.
That's
as well.
Amazing. Have you done
yes,
that before?
I have.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Whenever I went to Temecula for that bachelorette party, I flew into Sacramento and drove myself down the coast and stopped in San Luis Obispo and Los Olivos and all these places. And yeah, they were flipping cool. And my manager, we actually interviewed him last season. Aaron Benson suggested that I let them know I'm in the industry, and it completely changed the experience. And
that's amazing.
Yeah, and my other pro tip is you could also go to places like the Barossa and Hunter Valley in Australia, and all their wine is free. So, well, should
awesome.
We take a quick break?
Yeah, that was amazing.
Awesome.
I have so much knowledge. I need to wet my palate.
Oh my gosh, yeah. My mind is blown with the history of California.
All right, we'll be right back. Y'all, thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. We love creating this show for you, and we hope that you guys enjoy listening to it too.
That's right. And if you're a retailer or a producer and would like to have your product featured in our What You Drinkin' segment,
What You Drinkin'?
Send us an email at grapesingrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain at gmail.com.
And of course, find us on patreon.com/grapesandgrain if you'd like to pledge a monthly contribution to help us keep doing this.
Cheers, y'all. Well, welcome back, you guys.
Boop, boop.
We're excited. I hope you grabbed a drink. Loved hearing about our sponsors. And you can't talk about California without mentioning the really important regions. So,
oh, yeah.
Does beer break down in regions the way wine does?
Well, I mean, there are really important regions as in
hot spots. Yeah.
But sort of as we talked about last season with Texas, beer is a highly manufactured product. So like the biggest hubs are going to be, you know, off good highways and close to raw materials and things like that. And things where it's not too expensive to install equipment or whatever. Now, that's not to say there aren't rural
cheaper
breweries,
overhead.
But
yeah.
Most...
Oh my God, rural breweries.
Rural breweries. But the most important regions in California are a little different, because Northern California is pretty spread out and San Francisco is one of the most expensive places to live and do business. So that kind of goes against everything I just said. But clearly, Northern California is one of the big players in beer, considering not only its history, but also because it led the beer renaissance in America. So
that beer renaissance sounds so romantic.
It was, dude. I wish I'd been there.
Yeah. If only if I could go back to one time in history.
The beer renaissance.
Renaissance of San Francisco.
I just want to jump like in throughout history, just hit every renaissance. Renaissance ever. So up in NorCal, Sierra Nevada is still one of the leading craft brewers of the nation. They make every single year more than 1 million barrels of beer between its two locations, the flagship and original in Chico, California. And then they also have a brewery out in Mills River, North Carolina, which is near Asheville.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Little Creatures is doing that in Australia. Like, yeah, I guess it makes sense for these like craft breweries once they cheaper to just open up a second place than shipping it that far.
Totally. Yeah. Especially if you're making that much. A lot of breweries don't have the capability. Most don't have the capacity and network.
Capacity.
Capacity and ability to ship.
You heard it here. This first.
Okay, I'm going to move on. Another important brewery up in NorCal, Russian River.
Oh, yep.
Which is in Santa Rosa, because most people know its iconic Pliny the Elder IPA.
So good.
I have been there. I had the pleasure of going there actually when I went
fresh off the presses.
Yeah, well, we did. It was amazing. I'd never seen anything like it at the time. Their beer flight, it's 18 samples.
Whoa.
One of everything they have.
Whoa.
It was amazing. And then on that same trip, and also one of the biggest players is Lagunitas Brewing Company, which specializes in IPAs. They also have a location in Chicago. So clearly these are the big players right now. But the one of the most talked about places in California craft beer is San Diego, which is home to 206 breweries as of July 2018, which is just so many. Remember Texas, that's almost as many as the entire state of Texas.
Right.
And so you can't talk about California beer without mentioning the West Coast IPA. And the first brewery to really evoke the bigger is better mentality in beer was called Blind Pig Brewery in Temecula, which is south of L.A., but north of San Diego. And after that beer came out, everyone was trying to out-hop each other.
God, I remember that.
Yeah. So
I was like, so when I was pretty drinking beer, and there was some bitter stuff out there.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. This is when people started brewing all the way up to and past 100 IBUs. In 2011, Green Flash Brewing, which is in Southern California, they coined the term West Coast IPA, and that was the year that they trademarked it.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, the West Coast IPA resonates there. Stone Brewing Company in Escondida, California. They're one of the most foremost purveyors of IPAs in the country. And then one of my personal favorites, Ballast Point Brewing Company.
Should be one of everybody's personal favorites.
Yeah, and again, another iconic Sculpin IPA that comes in so many delicious flavors. Shout out Grapefruit Sculpin. Love you, BB. And just to prove the point about what a big deal they are and like their place in the scene, in 2015, a major beer or a major beverage conglomerate called Constellation purchased them for $1 billion.
Oh, my God.
It was the biggest deal in beer history.
That is nuts.
And then one last one from San Diego I'll mention, Carl Strauss Brewing Company.
Okay.
This is billed as one of the very first brew pubs to open in San Diego after Prohibition. It opened in 1989 and has 11 locations and numerous GABF awards. Every time I go to GABF, Carl Strauss is mentioned. So, you're okay. North, you're South. There's plenty in between, but those are going to be the big areas.
Cool. Well, clearly California has a little bit more defined wine regions.
I'm sure.
It's kind of what they do. So I guess I'll start out big and kind of like hone in small.
Okay.
So there's four primary wine producing regions within California. There is the North Coast, the Central Coast, the Central Valley, and then the South Coast.
Gotcha. I'm picturing this on a map, like it's pieces.
Everyone maybe hopefully knows what California looks like in their head. And if you don't, you can go to our website and we'll have a blog corresponding blog post for this episode soon. You can look at a map there. So, well, I'll start with the North Coast. So North Coast is where most of your really well-known regions are, like the Napa Valley, Sonoma Valley, Mendocino County, and Lake County.
Yeah, those are like the really, really popular ones.
Right. And the Mendocino is where the wine I brought today is from. And then each valley or county has a distinct AVAs within them. And remember from our episode last season, an AVA is the delineation of a region, and it stands for American Viticultural Area.
Oh, I was going to say agricultural viticultural area.
I like agricultural viticultural too. That's got a ring to it for sure.
Yeah, it flows.
Yeah. And so some notable AVAs within Napa are Howell Mountain, Stag's Leap, Oakville, and Napa's known for its Cabernet Sauvignon. Some notable AVAs within Sonoma are Russian River Valley, Dry Creek, Chalk Hills, and Sonoma's more known for its Pinot Noir.
Interesting.
And the next we have is Central Coast. Central Coast has a lot of great stuff going on there too. It's when you look at Central Coast, it's subdivided into two other regions, the North Central Coast and the South Central Coast. So in the North Central Coast, you have notable AVAs of Livermore Valley, Monterey County, Santa Cruz. And in the South Central Coast, is where I actually got to visit when I drove down there, is San Luis Obispo, Paso Robles, and Santa Barbara. And the area in the Central Coast is more known for its Pinot Noir, Syrah, Zinfandel, Cab Sauv, and Merlot.
Oh, yeah. They grow a lot there.
Yeah. And then, so from the Central Coast, you go more in-state into Central Valley.
Okay.
And
is there, like, a mountain range in between there?
You know, I'm not sure. I didn't look up the mountains because there's not that much happening of note in Central Valley.
Well, then why is it its own AVA?
Well, because it's kind of the catch-all. Because, you know, remember we said they made 90% of the country's wine. All of that is just these kind of lower quality grapes being grown in the Central Valley being made for the mass produced wineries out there. It's like the workhorse for the state. It actually grows in Central Valley. 75% of the grapes used in wine production.
Oh, wow.
Right. So, but if there's no like commercial wine tourism to the Central Valley, I mean, I'm assuming not like Napa.
Yeah. You know? It's more like production rather than
mass produced stuff. Yes, exactly. And then you get down to the South Coast. So the South Coast, like we're saying, is a little bit south of L.A., down towards San Diego and Mexico. The notable AVAs here are Temecula Valley, which we've mentioned several times, Malibu and San Diego County. And I found on numbers a pretty wide variance that there's between 1,200 and 1,600 wineries within California. And there's also over 100 different styles of grape varieties and over 100 AVAs in California as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
So, and it's very categorized because they're very like picky. You can't say it's from here or mm-hmm. like with this valley without it being like within this like border. So
yeah,
it's very structured.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of structure, you know, one thing we like to do in these regional highlights is talk a little bit about the laws that mm-hmm. are involved when you're dealing with the booze industry. There's a lot of regulation involved. Through my research, though, you know, I couldn't find too much. I know that for one thing, the California regulatory body is called the California Department of Alcohol Beverage Control. Mm-hmm. It was started in 1955 with the mission to protect California communities through excellence in alcohol regulation and education,
right.
Which is pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
But when I asked our mutual friend, Kara, I was like, hey, what are some weird things that you experience when you're going out to breweries or wineries or bars in general? She couldn't really think of anything, but she did mention something I think is interesting. Like, you can't drink alcohol at all in any form or fashion on, like, 90% of the beaches out there.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Which I found curious, considering...
It's like party time excellent.
Yeah.
California.
I think
party.
Of beach. I think of, I want a beverage on mm-hmm. the beach.
Totally, yeah.
But otherwise...
Because it's a pretty big community space there, though, also.
True,
yeah.
True. And litter and things like that, sure. Like, who wants to be walking on the beach? And like
stepping
on a beer
pina
bottle.
Colada glasses.
Yeah, that belongs on the boardwalk.
Tiki umbrella.
Yeah.
So, but with regard to beer laws, I reached out to a local brewer who used to work in California, and what he said is really like California is the beer state. It's very pro-business, it's very pro-small business, and it's very pro-brewery. So when we talk about weird-o things going on with Texas laws, California doesn't have a ton of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So
good for them.
Pretty
I'm not jealous at all. I'm not bitter. Good job, California. Way to be awesome.
Yeah.
With your beer laws. Well, there are, you know, various laws, like I was saying about the delineations and regions within California. The California ABC, or Alcohol Beverage Control, also regulates the production, importation, and sales of wine within California as well. But I did want to touch on the specific guidelines related to labeling wines within California.
I know labeling is a big thing here in Texas.
Yeah, yeah, and which I appreciate. You know what I mean? Like, if I'm going to spend my... I don't want to be, like, bamboozled by thinking I'm getting a Texas whiskey when I'm getting some, you know, Canadian BS. Or, you know...
A blend. Bottled.
Yeah. You know, and same people feel the same way about, you know, the grapes and everything. So I have three main... things I wanted to point out about the labels. To list a specific AVA or American Viticultural Area on a label, the wine must be made up of at least 85% grapes that were grown in that AVA in the area.
Gotcha.
To have
so
it listed on the
if
label.
You're growing a lot of your grapes in the Central Valley, mm-hmm. but like a little bit come from Sonoma or Mendocino, you can't just be like, ooh, we're from Mendocino County.
Exactly.
Your AVA.
Exactly.
people think you're way cooler than you are.
Mm-hmm. And also that kind of gives winemakers a little leeway. So maybe they had a really bad year and they need to like blend with something else 15%. Like it gives them a little like... wiggle room too.
Oh, yeah, that's nice.
So the second thing to point out is that to label a wine as a California wine, 100% of the grapes must be grown within California. That's true for Texas as well.
Yeah, I mean, that just is common sense.
Yeah, but here's something like a little twist about it. If you get a bottle of wine and it just says California wine or California red and doesn't have a Napa, Region, AVA, anything on it then you are, bet your bottom dollar it is grown in that Central Valley. Because that's just the nomenclature for that.
Gotcha. They're like, it's more about what you don't say.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then my very last thing is that if a label specifies a varietal or a certain kind of grape, the wine must contain at least 75% of that grape. Also, again, to keep you true to form, but if you need 25% to mellow it out and blend it and make it a better wine experience for your drinker, you have, again, a little play.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Laura, I know you've spent some time in California, spent some time drinking things from California. What are some of your favorite wineries out there?
Oh, definitely. Okay. Well, I narrowed it down to a couple of my top faves, and I hate to say so it's pretty Napa heavy, so I apologize in advance. But one of my favorite wines from California is from Trefethen. They're Dragon's Tooth. And again, that's in Napa. So the Dragon's Tooth is a blend of Malbec, Petit Verdot, Cab Sauv, and it's a delicious. And they also do a really great crisp, dry Riesling.
Mm.
And it's a great winery with a great story.
That's amazing.
Another one I really love is Tate's, which is a Cab Sauv from Napa as well. I personally love them because I won a sales competition at the wine bar I worked in, and I got a nice bottle of it, and that was the first bottle that started my cellar.
Oh, so, yeah. Yay!
And then I also really love Stoltman down in Los Olivos, and again, a little sentimental, the second bottle I ever put in my cellar was their Syrah after driving down the coast and visiting there.
Oh.
And I really like that winery. Not only do they make great wines, but they're really committed to the geology and the soil science within their area, and they talked at great length with me about that when I visited. So that was really neat.
Very cool.
Yeah. What about you? What is some of your favorite beers? I think I could guess a few, but...
Yeah. Well, you know, I haven't really spent that much time out in California drinking, per se.
Mm-hmm. I've visited a couple times. Specific areas,
specifically,
though,
but I remember one of the first times I went to San Francisco, I had 21st Amendment's Heller High Watermelon beer, and I love that beer so much. It's not a beer you can get in Texas, so that's one that's near and dear to my heart.
Awesome.
I also really like Mike Hess Brewing in San Diego. When I was just there last summer, my best friend took me there, and she was like, this Pilsner is my favorite Pilsner out of any beer ever. They had a really cool setup, so it was like you walked in the door, and you were immediately on this metal walkway, and on the second floor, and the breweries were right next to you, but they started on the first floor.
Mm.
And so they had a really good vibe, really great beers. Let's see. What else am I into? Oh, Bottle Logic and Modern Times are two breweries that I always like to try at Great American Beer Festival.
Oh, neat. Yeah, I didn't think about that. You get to try a lot of cool stuff when you go out
there.
Oh,
my gosh, tons. I mean, a lot of it runs together, but Modern Times, they both have huge reputations. And last year I was able to go with a brewer and sneak behind the booth and skip the Bottle Logic line to have some crazy berry sour beer.
Oh, wow.
The berry sour beers were all the rage last year. But
we should do an episode on sours and gizzes and stuff.
And now I also put down two breweries that I saw that I like their names, Belching Beaver and Fat Cat Brewing.
Yeah.
I really feel like a lot more brewers need to take that kind of creative approach to their naming. So shout out to those two beautiful animals.
Oh, that is so funny. Those majestic beasts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, cool. I would have to agree with your list. And this is a really great coming back, bringing it all back to the country and back to the table and to the mic with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And excited to be here. And makes me really excited to go to California the next time and try the more beer and more wine. So
let's go. Let's get out there.
All right.
I'm ready. Yesterday.
I'll raise a glass to that. Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. If you'd like to be featured on our future listener mail segment, please email any questions, comments, or anecdotes to grapesandgrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain@gmail.com.
You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Grapes and Grain Podcast. Remember, that's grapes plural and grain singular.
Find us online at grapesandgrainpodcast.com to see blog posts that go more in depth to each episode. You can also download or stream the podcast there.
And of course, find us on Patreon.com/grapesandgrain if you'd like to pledge a monthly contribution. And a huge thank you to Jack and Dorothy Studios for having us in today. We couldn't do it without you, Ben.
Thanks so much for listening to our podcast today. Cheers.
What you drinking?